You are Locked On Nuggets, your daily Denver Nuggets podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
What is up, everybody, and welcome to the Locked On Nuggets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. I'm your host, Adam Mattes, and I'm not joined by Matt Moore today. He's got the day off, but I got a special guest who is a friend of the show, recurring guest, and an expert on all things Timberwolves, host of the Dane Moore podcast. It's Dane Moore. Dane, thanks for joining me over on this side now.
Yes, sir, man. I'm filling in the Moore role, I guess, on this episode. Was that a good joke? That was a really good joke.
Well, I guess, I guess that's right. Yeah, we have Matt Moore, now we have Dane Moore. I guess Matt should have been the one to interview. That would have been even better. We appreciate you guys making this show your first listen each and every day. We're free and available wherever you get your podcasts. We're going to be talking about Tim Connelly, who has recently joined Minnesota, kind of get Dane's perspective now that he's gotten to know him a little bit, settled in, and has been covering the various press conferences. We're also going to talk about Ryan Saunders, the new Nuggets assistant coach, who was the former Minnesota Timberwolves coach. Very incestuous, these two teams, over the last 4 or 5 years. Lots of co-mingling. And then lastly, we're going to talk about Andrew Wiggins, former Minnesota Timberwolves superstar. Actually, I should say former Minnesota Timberwolves semi-bust, I guess, turned finals MVP candidate. We're going to talk about that, what maybe some of it means, as well as some of the big trends around the NBA. But let's start, Dane, with Tim Connelly. I went on your show. We talked a little bit about sort of the expectations and this or that. But I want to kind of, because I know this backstory, I want the audience to kind of know. Fan bases can get attached to coaches. They can get attached to front office personnel. They can get attached to various people that are not just necessarily players. We all know they get attached to players. But there was, if I understand the situation correctly, Sachin Gupta? Do I say this right? He was a sort of beloved figure with Minnesota fans, I would say, to a certain extent. What was sort of the relationship there and kind of set the table before Tim Connelly's arrival?
Well, Adam, I think fans get really attached to players. And I think in the media, we tend to get really attached to front office members, right? Like, that's what we were going back and forth, just talking about Connelly, right? And how much you liked him.
Well, I wonder, because it does sometimes cross. Like, Daryl Morey became, who started the process? Sam Hinkie, for example, became a cult figure. So there are these, like, certain general managers that transcend that. Because I think you're right. Most
well, Gupta was with Hinkie. So Gupta was with him. He was his number two. So, I mean, you know, back in the day when the process was going on, I was fascinated by it just from like from afar watching the NBA. Like, this is new. And so I was pretty tuned into who Sachin Gupta was back then. I mean, he was like 27 years old when the process started. He's Sam Hinkie's number two. It was like those two were here, and then the rest of the front office and scouting were different. So he was just, I mean, he invented the ESPN trade machine. He's just kind of an interesting.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that detail. That's a cool detail.
Yeah. He's just an interesting character that, you know, before I met him in person was like, who is this dude? You know? Right. And then similar to how you've gotten to know Tim over the years, I've gotten to know Sachin kind of in like a friend sort of way where you're just kind of learning about the way they think and the way they act. And I was just always sort of impressed by, you know, the way he handled himself, the way he's such like a listener, took information in and is brilliant. You know, he's just objectively a brilliant like person, MIT, all this sort of stuff. And so I think for me, you kind of are like, what, you know, particularly in Minnesota, we've had all this dysfunction, terrible presidents of basketball operations forever. Yeah. I'm like, oh, here we go. Normal guy who seems to be smart, like great. And I think even at the beginning, prior to even just a few weeks ago when I had you on, I was like, man, I've heard great things about Tim Connelly, but like, do we need change to have a change?
Right,
it seems like we got a fine thing going here. So I don't know. Was he beloved? I wouldn't go that far, because it was really just 1 year that he was in charge. He took over for Rosa's last season. He didn't mess it up, but he didn't really, like, some fans push back that Gupta was good at all because he didn't make any moves at the trade deadline, and they're just very isolated on what has he done thus far in Minnesota. Nothing really.
As an aside here, this is one of my favorite things about talking to people from other markets and fan bases or what have you, is that every fan base is the same because people are the same way about like literally everything about the Nuggets. I'm sure there's a player that the fan base kind of blames everything for. There's always a front office guy. It's, is he the best ever? Is he the worst ever? Is the coach the worst ever? Is he the best ever? You could always like make in sports and every fan base reacts the exact same. So it's kind of a funny little comment there.
It is. It is. And I think what I have now like moved through is this idea of like, okay, it's not going to be Sachin. It's going to be Tim. Let's start developing relationship with him. Let's start learning about who Tim Connelly is. And I mean, honestly, you've been a big source for me in what his background is and what he does. And, you know, I'm really on board with that. And as of right now, Gupta's here too. So right. I'm like, all right, this is a pretty dynamic 1-2 when again, in Minnesota, dynamic would not be the way that you would historically right. describe right. their front offices.
And then the other piece of this is that, you know, there's a change of ownership going on in Minnesota now. And we see this all the time. If you look at the roster, it doesn't seem right for a giant shakeup. Like you wouldn't come in and trade Towns, right? You wouldn't. And then you have Chris Finch, who I think is a very good coach. And I think most people are like, hey, we're curious to see where this goes. New owners often come in and want to make a big splash. It almost seems like, okay, the star's not the big splash. The coach is not the big splash. Maybe the front office. That's our way to make a big splash. It almost feels like a little bit of that going on where this is their first introduction. Like, here we are. We're putting our stamp early in our tenure.
I mean, honestly, Adam, like go back 12 months, even before Rosas was fired and Gupta took over, I started hearing about how Alex Rodriguez and Mark Lowry, the new owners, wanted a quote unquote top five GM. And I started like trying to figure, I'm like, okay, well, what does that mean? Who are these top five guys? And I had heard that Tim Connelly was on that. It was a stupid list. It was like right, Pat right, Riley, right. Daryl yeah. Morey, whatever. But then I was like, the one that always stood out to me on there was maybe the most attainable is Tim Connelly. Not that I thought it was going to happen, right. but it wasn't Pat Riley. You know what I mean? So it's really been a pursuit for them to, I don't know, at least do their due diligence to try and find a elite lead executive to run the team. And here we are, you know, not even 12 months later, and they have Tim Connelly, you know, locked up long term.
How has the fan base responded to this? Has it been big news? Is it favorable news? What's kind of been the response?
Yeah, I think it's positive because to a lot of people, again, if you're not fully in the weeds of who Sachin Gupta is, he kind of felt like an interim guy. We were waiting yeah. around for whoever the permanent person was going to be, and we didn't know who the permanent person was going to be. And now it's Tim Connelly, who has a track record of, you know, 9 years in Denver that
right.
objectively gets a good grade. So I think, I mean, mostly the Timberwolves fan base is just like, please don't do anything that's going to not set us back for right, 5 years. Because right. that's happened, you know, David Kahn, Tom Thibodeau, a lot of different Gerson Rosas, a lot of executives here. It's like, man, every time it feels like we get a little bit of momentum building in the right direction, it's not even a rebuild. It's like let's pull all the weeds and start right. all over again. And the fan base, quite frankly, and understandably, I think is exhausted by that. And Conley kind of feels like a tweak a little bit more, even though it's a big move. I don't know. Does that make sense? Where it doesn't feel like a total dismantling and starting over, because the Timberwolves shouldn't dismantle and start over, right? They just made the playoffs.
I think what you're getting at is that, like, Thibodeau, he's known for being it's go time. Like, doesn't matter if it actually is. He's always go time. And I think Tim Connelly's MO has not really been that. We've actually never seen him push all the chips forward. Some people say that that was maybe a flaw of his in Denver. I tend to think that the moment for that was now. So we never got to see if he did it at the right moment. So that's one of the things that'll be interesting to kind of follow him and follow what happens in Minnesota is just, does he do the thing now? They're not really in position for the long rebuild. So it's more mm-hmm. of a like, hey, they're kind of at go time too. Maybe one step behind Denver in that process, but not far. So it'll be kind of interesting to see what they do. Did you happen to catch Josh Kroenke's presser or any part of it in his sort of, did you see the whole thing or did you catch the little clip?
I read Harrison and Singer on it and, you know, the quotes of what was the desperate, you know, those sort of things.
Startup, desperate. Yeah. A lot of
I mean, I get why they're pissed.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I don't know. Like, desperate has a negative connotation to it. I do think it was a desperate move by the Timberwolves. But, like, not in a
Totally.
I don't know, not in a bad way. It's like,
right.
This is the way Mark Laurie and Alex Rodriguez work. Like, they're VC guys. Like, they're going to go fast. Yeah. So that is, I think, maybe to somebody who's a little bit older and slower or whatever, it comes off as a little bit desperate. I mean, it's a huge deal. It's a huge deal. Like, they've given him, I mean, we haven't been able to pin down exactly what this equity thing is, because I don't think they want that out there publicly in any sort of way. But there's
any party wants that out there. Yeah.
Yes. Right. But there's something involved there too. So it was a can't miss offer for Conley.
I almost get the sense, by the way, Dane, it's funny that you say don't have the details, because I didn't have them either. And I didn't know if it was known outside, because I feel like in Tim Conley's case, you almost get the sense that he doesn't want it out there because it's maybe smaller than people would have expected. And Minnesota doesn't want it out there almost because it is something, and then they don't want the something out there. So it's kind of this funny, they're almost pushing in opposite directions.
I think you're right. I think the way Glenn Taylor put it at the press conference was, he called it a bonus program, where if the Wolves do well, Conley does even better. So I think what I've heard is, it's like, he has the opportunity to buy into the organization, which is a good, you know, whatever. If you invest, if Tim invests a handful of his money into it, it's a pretty good investment to invest in an NBA team. And not many people have the opportunity to do that. So that's why I understand the equity portion of it to be, which altogether is a hell of a lot more than what Denver offered him, one way or the other.
I want to keep talking. There's more to get to on Tim Conley as well as with Ryan Saunders, but I got to hit a break here and tell you guys about Effortless Rehab. It was no accident. For 23 years, the Utah Jazz had half the number of injuries as other teams. Hall of Famers John Stockton, Karl Malone remain two of the least injured players over the last 40 years. And a lot of that had to do with a program called AMIT, and that is the same practice that is that goes on with Dr. Weisfeld over at Effortless Rehab. I actually went over there. He said, hey, I want you to do this ad read, but I also want you, I know that you, I've listened to the pod, he's a Locked On Nuggets listener, he's a Nuggets fan. He said, I want you to come over and get this treatment because I know you've had some injuries, and just see if it works. And if it does, great, you can give an endorsement. So I went down there very skeptical. It's a little bit of a strange and unique program, sort of like chiropractic work, sort of like rehab, physical therapy, and then a little bit like almost, you know, just something completely different. He kind of did some stretches on me. It was a 2-hour process. It was my left quadricep that I'd had an injury to about 6 years ago, about a 2-hour treatment, and then started doing some one-legged squats just to see if I could go lower than before, could go longer, you know, do longer before. And to my surprise, it actually worked, and it worked great. And not only that, Dr. Weisfeld has followed up with me several times. He's communicated throughout the entire process. It's really great. So if you have a sports injury, or it doesn't even have to be that, it could just be something like carpal tunnel or sitting at a desk, you get that tech neck, you're kind of cranking your neck down all the time. Maybe you have some injuries there. You want to just kind of see if some of your muscles turned off. Can Dr. Weisfeld and his AMIT program get them turned back on? Why don't you find out? EffortlessRehab.com/appointments. You can make that appointment online. It's just $35. It's this great deal that he has for Locked On listeners. Just $35 for one area. Again, EffortlessRehab.com/appointments. Or you can call 303-300-3933. Again, I went and tried this out. I thought it was great. He was great to work with. So I highly recommend it, Effortless Rehab. Also want to tell you about Prize Picks. They're a big sponsor that we have here. Are you looking for daily fantasy options for the NBA? Then you need to try the award-winning app Prize Picks. It's daily fantasy made easy, and it's easy to use. You pick up 2 to 5 players, and you pick their over or under on their projections, and you can win up to 10 times on any entry if it's just you versus the projected numbers. Entries can be made in 60 seconds or less. Prize Picks is safe and offers fast withdrawals. It also has a variety of different options. So, for example, tomorrow night you could bet on Klay Thompson, Game 6 Klay, over on the three-pointers. You could also take Jason Tatum under on points, as I would recommend doing. And then you could win, so you can combine those different bets. So right now, for a limited time, Prize Picks has an exclusive no-brainer offer for all of these users. Get $50 for free if a player in your first Prize Pick entry scores a single point. But you got to use promo code NBA. That's right, the exclusive offer for Locked On fans. Use promo code NBA and get $50 if your player scores a single point. Back here for segment two on Locked On Nuggets. I've got Dane Moore with me. We're talking Tim Connelly. We're going to talk Ryan Saunders here in just a second. One of the things that's interesting about Tim Connelly that I kind of think about is some of the benefits. When I talk to fans, everybody just looks at the moves. It's funny, depending on how you zoom out, like if you zoom really closely, you could say, okay, well, look at some of these specific most recent trades. They didn't work out. Malik Beasley got traded basically for nothing. Now he's a big piece there. You zoom out a little bit more and you can almost point to like, okay, but look at where the team is. The team has grown. And I think that's what Minnesota's doing. They're saying, okay, here's some of the success. You can zoom out even further from that and try to look even more broadly. I think some of the things that I look at with Tim that were especially valuable. One thing that I don't think fans know is he was among the more plugged in people in the NBA because he's an extremely likable person. He's affable. He knows how to talk to any type of person. He just has friends everywhere. And I know one of the things that was consistent for the Nuggets over his tenure was they tended to know every pick and every thought that was going on in the rest of the league. And by the way, this is a scale. More information is exchanged than people realize. I think with Tim Connelly, he's a guy that is very plugged in to other teams and what they're doing. And I think that's part of what gives him an advantage. What's your perspective? Do you have any perspective on that specific trait? And is it a thing that you've seen from different front offices?
I had a Tim on my show last week, and he kind of talked about that and the sort of the irony of where, you know, he moves from 21 with Denver to 19 where the Wolves are, and then Arturas Karnišević right. is at 18.
Yeah.
And so what he was saying is he knew people here, obviously, when he was in Denver, and he knew Chicago. And he's like, we had this great WhatsApp chat going on all the time where we were exchanging information on all these different prospects, because it is kind of one of those things, right, where, you know, you can't know everything. And I do think you're absolutely right. There is this exchange of information. He's like, but once you found out that the Bulls are at 18, the Wolves are at 19, and the Nuggets are at 21, he's like, that's kind of died down a bit. But I'm totally with you. In, you know, the brief time I've gotten to know him, he's extremely personable and just the type of guy that I think you would feel safe sort of like exchanging information with.
Well, I think it's the intel piece of this that's so important, because when people are thinking about is a guy good or are they bad or this or that, it's really about your front office. There are guys that are in a front office who are just there for information. Like, they are information gatherers. There are people, and the Nuggets have had a guy like this. I mean, they're more than that. I'm not reducing them to any one thing, but they've had guys like this who scout Europe very well, but their real value isn't necessarily in their insight. I mean, that's part of it, but it's more in that they get the access that nobody else does, and they get the information that nobody else does because they know everyone. So it's like, hey, we're all scouting, and all the scouts are at the Real Madrid final, and they're all watching this guy. Meanwhile, so-and-so has actually been watching him all week because he's been in the behind-the-scenes practice, and he gets the intel, and he's talking to the different coaches, and that's a leg up. I think that's one of the things that Tim Connelly has, and the statute of limitations has passed on this story, so I get to share a little bit of a behind-the-scenes story here. The 2017 draft is one of Tim Connelly's worst. They end up trading back. They get Trey Lyles, and they're trying to target, I think everybody knows, OG Anunoby. The thing that happened in this draft that I don't think some people were – I've seen it over the years, like, you got too cute, you got bad intel. Not the case at all. Denver knew exactly that OG was going to go to Toronto, I believe, at 23. When they made the deal, they were operating under an assumption that Brooklyn wanted Jared Allen. They knew that was the case. And they knew if they made this trade back, they could trade up their second round pick to move up two spots, leapfrog Toronto, because they knew Toronto wanted OG. They knew they wanted OG. And they knew that Toronto did not want Jared Allen. So moving up two spots, their wholesale was logically sound. Do this deal. Toronto's not going to take your guy. Your guy is still going to be there. We win, you win, plus you get this extra pick in there. And for some reason, Brooklyn wouldn't do it. They just wouldn't do it, even though it was 100% right, and Denver ends up getting burned. Now, a mistake's a mistake. It really hurt Denver. But it's funny that that's a type of deal that gives you a little bit of insight of you have an advantage to you when you know everybody's intel, when you have, you know, sort of spies almost every single way. And then the flip side of this, Dane, is, and I'm curious to see how this plays out in Minnesota, another one of Tim Connelly's traits, in my opinion, was that he had a very loyal group, because I think he's a very loyal guy. So this is a two-way street. Lots of intel everywhere else, not to lots of intel coming from outside his organization. And I think that's a strategic advantage that probably gets overlooked.
Well, we had the same problem in Minnesota back in the Jarrett Culver draft, where Culver went six. and Darius Garland ended up going five, and nobody thought Cleveland was going to take Garland because they'd taken Sexton the year before. Mm. And so I think that was a situation where Rosas did not actually have, well, certainly didn't have the right information on what Cleveland was going to do, because they traded up a few hours before the draft from 11 to 6 to get Garland. And then they're kind of left there at 6 with their pants down because, you know, he wasn't there. And it ends up, I don't know, it's actually very similar because it was Tyler Lydon, right, that Denver took?
Yeah, it was Tyler Lydon, yep.
Major bust, Jarrett Culver, major bust. It's like, if it goes wrong, it goes right. wrong, you know? So, right. I do think you're absolutely right that is this super underrated and kind of hard to quantify thing right. for us in the media as to, you know, what's going on. We just kind of like, as I just did with Tim Connelly the past month, was like, whoa, who were his draft picks? What were the trades he made? Like, that is literally such a small portion of how to accurately assess who and what he is as a lead executive.
No question about it. And like, the end result's what matters the most, but it is important also to know how you arrive there. It is dumb luck if there's a process or if there's something to it that can predict future success. Let's move on now though to Ryan Saunders. So I think the story with him, it's funny. Now I have to ask the questions because I don't have the insight here. My perspective on Ryan Saunders is that he was one of the worst coaches of the last 10 years. And I think there's layers to this that make that a little unfair. One is he was one of the youngest coaches the last 10 years. He was kind of put into a weird spot with his father passing away and then taking over. The team was kind of in disarray. I mean, these are years that were really rough on Karl-Anthony Towns. They were rough on everybody, but they were rough on the Timberwolves in particular as the Butler era is disintegrating. So my question is, number one, what do you make of Ryan Saunders as a coach? And number two, why did he fail as a head coach, or why did he have such a losing record?
Well, first and foremost, I think Ryan should not have taken that job. And part of that, and a lot of people say, oh, it's because he was 32 when he took it. And, you know, maybe that's part of it. But I think, I mean, this was Ryan's dream job. His like life goal was to hopefully someday be able to coach the Minnesota Timberwolves, where his dad coached. He grew up here. And I think he got a little bit like blinded or aspirational, because of that, like, because he wanted that so bad, when in reality it was a terrible job to take at the time. Yeah. One, I guess, yeah, just the cat part of it. It was a terrible time in Cat's life. Those were his worst years of his career, because he was just a little understandably lost at that time. But also, I mean, what's kind of come out after the fact of Ryan getting fired is it was an extremely dysfunctional relationship between he and Gerson Rosas. And really, like, I mean, Rosas interviewed Chris Finch at the time that when they were looking to hire a coach, they ultimately kept Ryan Saunders. I mean, the perspective I have is I think Ryan was just kind of the scapegoat, and they knew they were going to be bad for 2 years. They knew they were going to actively tank for 2 years, prioritize playing young players, mandate that they play young players. And I mean, man, when you don't have a very talented roster, your best player is going through it, like, and your front office wants you to tank. I mean, you're going to have two bad years where you lose a ton. And now that all sounds to like defend Ryan some, but I just think it was a terrible situation. And I think to some extent, Ryan was a little in over his head in terms of the coaching part of it too.
Was he 31 or 32 when he got the job? I mean, he was really young.
32. He was 32 years old. Crazy.
I mean, he's younger than some of the guys on the team.
He was younger than Taj Gibson on that team that year. Luol Deng was on the team. Yeah, it was like,
that's almost unheard of.
Oh, totally. I mean, it was a little bizarre. But I thought the one my critique with him, my biggest critique I had that like full year with him was I don't think he handled the rotations well. Mm. And they didn't have a deep bench or anything like that. But it was just like one of those things where you're like, okay, we have three bench players in for 6 minutes. There is no way they're keeping the score close. It was just every single time like that. And I would have liked to see, and I talked about it at the time, different rotation tweaks. Now, what I found out after the fact is I don't know how much freedom he had to actually control his own rotation. Like, it was not it was not a good, it was not a good setup in that way, where he didn't have the freedom to do what he wanted. Right. And I think that's gonna haunt him, because you're right. The public perception is that Ryan Saunders has been one of the worst NBA head coaches in the past decade or so. I don't know if that's completely true. What I know is Ryan is like a very good assistant coach. And I think, to the Denver standpoint, and I know that from talking to a lot of the players who swear by him, who worked with him one-on-one, and just from around the league, like, that's basically when I ask people about it, you know, with Ryan, they're like, man, he's a great assistant coach. I don't know if he's ready to be a head coach at that time, just because he's so young. But
I don't think people realize those are two different skill sets. It's not that, like, yes, you're so good at being an assistant that you get to a level where now you're good at being a head coach. Some people are just great at being an assistant. It's a different skill set. Some overlap, but a different skill set for the most part. And that might be your role. Might be for Ryan Saunders. It might also just be that he was too young. I mean, we'll find out.
Well, and Adam, it's like, what I didn't realize until I got into media was like, man, you got to do a lot of like public speaking as a head coach in the league. And like, Ryan is a very shy person, by nature. And I think that wore on him, the fact that they were losing a ton, and he has to be talking constantly. Maybe he isn't allowed to be talking openly. I mean, it was just a messy, messy situation. But in all honesty, like, I don't think by any means he is underqualified to be a top, maybe like lead top assistant around the league. So that's why I'm not surprised at all that Denver has made this move. I as somebody who covered those terrible teams, I think if anyone should think Ryan's a bad coach, it would be me. And I don't think he'll be bad at that role at all.
I want to pull on something you said there, which is that he's kind of a shy personality. And you mentioned this with regards to public speaking, which he won't have to really do. But I do wonder, like, Michael Malone always talks about, he's a type who naturally, and I believe this about him, he's a guy that is comfortable with confrontation. He kind of thrives in it. He doesn't mind it at all. And I think he's a guy that can be intimidating to people who are not, but who actually needs that confrontation constantly. He needs people challenging him. And I wonder, is Ryan Saunders a guy, I don't know him, is he a guy that you think is going to be comfortable challenging somebody who's going to make you earn, like make you change his mind?
No, I don't think so. He'll have his opinions and stuff, but is he going to be the person pounding on the table like, this is a terrible idea, Mike? I don't know. I don't think that's really his personality. I think his best attribute is being able to connect with players and work with players and grow players. And that's not that he's I don't think he's like a bad X's and O's guy, but it's not his personality to be boisterous.
Right.
And I mean, on the sidelines and stuff, when he's in competition, sure. Like, he would get ticked on the sidelines and all that, but
you know what I'm saying here? Like, Michael Malone's a New Yorker. He's a quick wit. Like, he's really quick. You throw an insult at him, he's got one ready to go right back at you. He's like that type of guy. He's sharp and he just thrives on that sort of back and forth. And I just, like, David Adelman, who's the other lead assistant, seems like a quiet guy too, who I think has really good perspective in this or that. But I sometimes wonder if there's anybody on staff that can walk into his office and say, you got to cut this shit out. You got to get this guy out of the rotation and put this guy in. What are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, maybe. It's funny, David Adelman, another weird Wolves Nuggets connection here. He was here when his dad was the coach. I don't know. What I do know is Malone and Saunders are super tight. Like, they go back, and I know there was conversations last year when after Saunders had been fired and when Unseld was moving to Washington that Ryan was a potential option to, you know, to add to the bench in Denver last year. So it's, I think it's fair to say it's somebody that Mike Malone highly values, and you know, I think we should trust Mike Malone as a coach with a successful background that, you know, he's considered the being challenged part of it and understands that he needs that. And maybe, I don't know, maybe he has that from somewhere else on the bench, or maybe I'm underrating Ryan in that way. I would just say, again, Ryan's best skill set is relating with players and getting them to trust him. Cause he is, if Ryan's not anything else, he's a good dude. Like, I loved my time getting to know Ryan and as a person and covering him.
So what about this is the last one with Ryan Saunders, but you know, he's enters as a sort of de facto defensive coordinator. I mean, Jordy Fernandez, Wes Unseld was tasked with that. Then Jordy took over for a year when he left. Right. By all accounts, that's the role that is sort of vacated here. It's not lost on me that the Timberwolves got better after he was no longer the head coach on the defensive end and changed up schematically some of the things they were doing. Is he, in your opinion, a defensive mind?
Well, okay. So the Wolves exclusively played drop with when Saunders was here, but that was a Gerson Rosas decision. They hired David Vanderpool specifically from Portland, who Portland had just come off of that 1 year where they were like eighth on defense out of nowhere. And Nurkic was, you know, just lurking by the rim. And they're like, okay, well, that Rosas was like, that's what we want. That's how we want to use Cat. They called it solid is enough, which I just thought was kind of a weak thing because it turned out it wasn't.
That's a rallying cry, man. Like, solid is enough.
They would hammer that home. Like, this is cool. I'm like, this is not cool. You guys are terrible at this. I thought it was, I mean, Tibbs used Cat in the same way. The reason the Wolves got better defensively this year is they took Cat out of that. They played the most aggressive defensive scheme in the league. I mean, they threw Cat up at the level every single time. And that was, I honestly, personally, something I wanted to see them do because I'd seen 6 years of Cat be back at the rim and not have any success being able to do that. I think Ryan saw that too. I don't think it was Ryan's choice. Vanderpool was in charge of the defense as kind of a Rosa's proxy there. I think what Ryan will do is kind of try and fine tune the system that Denver's been running defensively since Millsap, like 5 years ago, once he really activated Jokic a little bit more. I do think it's Ryan's skill set. I would say in Minnesota though, he had significantly more offensive influence than he had defensive influence on that team.
It's an interesting note. Vanderpool's an interesting one too, because five years ago, whatever it was, the Portland breakout happened. I remember he was like the number one next head coach a lot of it. Right? And it is interesting to think of a guy who maybe this happens a lot. I think in today's NBA where the game's evolving, there are people that have one good idea and they're labeled a genius and they actually only understand the one good idea. Then the game changes or they have different personnel. And it's like, hey, that no longer works. You've kind of expired. And there's actually some great coaches that I think fit that mold. I think in today's game, the organizations that succeed the most are the ones that have this sort of intuition about the game, meaning it's not just that they have this one idea. It's that they kind of feel the game in a certain way. But also
like Finch.
What's that? Like Finch. Yeah, I think
Finch is that offense way.
It's like, yeah, like, you know what? He's seeing it on the abstract level. And to me, that's what's so interesting. And it actually relates perfectly to our next topic on the other side, which is Andrew Wiggins, who I think somehow, some way, Golden State had this intuition or this insight into what he was and what he could be that really paid off. Maybe you disagree with that sort of, but we'll kind of talk about it on the other side. But first, betonline.net is your number one source for all your betting stats and sport inspo. Find all the latest sports developments, news, and odds, including this year's basketball championship matchup, the NHL Hockey Conference Finals, Major League Baseball, and of course, all the latest fighting news in MMA to UFC to boxing. BetOnline is your continued source for all your sports wagering information, including live betting, esports, and more. Head to the website or use your mobile device to learn more about the trends in action. BetOnline, where the game starts. We'll be back with more Locked On Nuggets. Back here for the final segment, Locked On Nuggets. Thanks for making it your first listen every day. Make sure you go check out Locked On NBA Big Board. Host Rafael Barlow from NBA Draft Junkies and author of the NBA Big Board newsletter is joined by Richard Stateman, Sam Ferris, and Leif Thulin, giving fans an in-depth look at the NBA Draft, mock drafts, player rankings, and of course, Big Boards. It's free and available wherever you get your podcast. So Andrew Wiggins is the breakout star of the 2022 NBA playoffs, might be number one breakout star. This is the type of, we all have different things we like about basketball. One of my favorite things is this idea of every team needs lots of different roles. And when guys that are better, you know, quote unquote, better than the role for which they accept, it's one of the most beautiful things there is because it often leads to winning. Andrew Wiggins was the last guy I would have predicted to become a great role player. really one of the last guys, because I kind of pictured him as a guy that, one, didn't necessarily have the heart for this. I didn't know if he was as motivated as you need to be a champion. I didn't know if he had the skill set and feel for the game and all those different things. He leaves Minnesota, where I think that reputation was well earned. This is my perspective on it, was well earned. He gets into a different situation 2 years later. Here he is having an enormous impact, maybe the second best player on the Warriors, who are up 3-2. I'm good friends with David Naylor. I talk to him a lot. He's a Timberwolves fan. Hates Andrew Wiggins. And I always find it funny because part of me wants to sit back. This is my perspective. Tell me if I'm wrong. Part of me wants to say you could hate him, but when somebody leaves an organization and then gets unlocked, it's probably a little bit of a two-way street, that maybe there was a little ruining or something that didn't lead to him getting unlocked. What's your perspective on Andrew Wiggins? And are you a guy that has a little resentment watching him be the perfect version of himself?
I don't know if it's resentment. I mean, I think one of my biggest theories on Andrew, and it's not even really a basketball thing, is I think as humans, we all kind of like turn the adult switch on in our lives at different times, like sometime in our early 20s.
Sure.
And I think with Andrew, he was still kind of in like the college kid mode, you know, for a while in his early 20s. And it seemed, and from what people I talked to when he was here, that started to really change his final year in Minnesota after he had a kid. And
interesting.
And you saw him become a little bit more mature. I mean, Wig was actually pretty good. He got traded in the middle of that season. That season he started, you know, he started really strong. He was locked in. He was in a more of a primary role, but in ways it kind of looked like what we are seeing when it's a lesser role, but the way he isolates and the explosiveness, right. we called it downhill Wig here, where it's like, okay, keep going. Don't stop at 16 feet and shoot it because you're not good at those. But when he would get downhill and get all the way to the basket, you know, there was consistent flashes from Andrew Wiggins. But what would always happen in the course of the year is he'd get bored, particularly before that switch came on. And we'd always joke and be like, all right, it's a Tuesday night against Charlotte. Here comes, you know, 14 points, 2 boards, and 1 assist from Wiggins. Like, right. It was clockwork. But on the other side of it, if they were playing Cleveland, who traded him, if they were playing Toronto, where he's from Canada, like, you knew Wiggins was going to have a big game when he decided to care. And that sounds bad, but it makes sense that now he decides to care, right? I'm back. So it's not surprising to me that's where he's caring more in the NBA finals, and we're seeing him be effective and rebounding the ball, man. That's an effort thing. Like, I'm not surprised at all that he has 29 rebounds in the last two games, and they've been two long games. Like, it's always been about effort with Wiggins, and you're seeing consistent effort here.
One of the things that I think is interesting is, how does a team, and I don't know whose job this is, I think it's everybody's, the organizations, in some ways, the fan base in a weird way, but I think especially the players, I think it's mostly the teammates that create a reward structure for doing the right thing. Because I think there's this tendency to be like, and you have agents in your ear telling you this, if you do the right things and you lower your scoring by maybe 4 points, but your efficiency goes up by 10% and you grab a few extra rebounds, guess what? You don't get paid. Like, we've seen this so many times. You get paid for other things. And Andrew Wiggins, was on a maligned max contract, but he's on a max contract nonetheless. Like, he did the things that he needed to do to get that, because it was all upside. Whereas maybe if he did all the right things, and the Timberwolves are an 8 seed for 3 straight years, maybe guys are like, I don't know, he's just a glorified role player, this or that. So there's a weird dynamic there. But what I think is great, and what I think is interesting, when you win, if you win, do it by doing the right things, you get heralded. Like, Andrew Wiggins' Q score right now amongst analysts and fans is at an all-time high, yet his scoring is down. Like, his rebounding is up, his scoring is down, he's guarding Jason Tatum and shutting him down. So it's one of those things where it doesn't work out for everyone, but if you get into the right team where those reward structures are correct, and I think the Golden State Warriors are probably the best in the NBA at this, they praise guys for fitting into the system and fan bases, and it pays off, then you get rewarded. And I just look at Andrew Wiggins right now, and I think, he's a 99th percentile role player. And role player is not, I'm not using that dismissively. It's very important. Draymond Green's kind of a role player. He's the 99th percentile role player. And I just think it's the coolest thing.
I think it is. I think it is too, and I think it's the right fit for him. It'll be interesting to see. You know, he's got one more. He's extension eligible. He's got one more year left on his deal, and if he does get to, you know, unrestricted free agency in a year, I'm fascinated to see what that market looks like, and if some team wants to again try and pay him or bring him in to be like a number two, because I don't think that will work at all. This is who I think Andrew has to be. And I think some of it offensively is as simple as he's not an efficient offensive player, but he can always get his shot because he is so athletic and he is so big. And you think about it, like, really simply in like Minnesota, it was always so much like isolation, come into the mid-range, pull up. That was the primary offense, one of the primary sources of offense on this team. And that just isn't that valuable. But that's a negative value play, right, in early offense. But what you see in Golden State is, like, oftentimes he's taking those mid-range jumpers and he's attacking and it's late in the shot clock.
Yeah.
And a 40% 16-footer when you have 4 seconds left on the shot clock is actually profitable given, you know, where you're at in time and situation. So to that extent, I think it fits very well offensively. And then on defense, if you got a fire lit under his ass, like – He's going to guard better. He did that in Minnesota. He was situationally a good defender here, like in one-on-one situations. And if that was just his matchup, he always had the physical attributes to do it. So I think that's just a slightly more nuanced way of saying, like, yeah, he's better as a fourth option on a team or a third option. And I think it'll be naive for a team to overreact to what is happening right now in this Q score, this 99th percentile, and again, pay him to be a top option on the team, because I just don't think that's the archetype of player that he is.
The funny thing is he's so valuable at the things that are needed, primarily like wing defense. Like, he's just good at that plus the offense, that he probably will get paid even if he just does. Like, you might just pay him just to be that. You might not even want him to be more than that. You just say, hey, you're going to come in and be our third option now and do that. And he might be valuable. The reason it's interesting to me though most is, to me, the comp there is mostly Michael Porter. I think a lot of people put Aaron Gordon as the comp. Like, that could be Denver. Him and Aaron Gordon kind of have similar things in that everybody knows they're not good enough to be the number one or two guy. But I actually think the better comp might be Michael Porter Jr. in this very interesting way. Michael Porter is a much better scorer. I know it's going to sound crazy, than Andrew Wiggins, in just the term of that he's so efficient. Even in these last few years, he's so efficient. And I don't think
that's controversial at all.
Just because Andrew Wiggins averaged more points. Like, I think Michael Porter averaged 18 points. It's the top. So some people would say, well, he's never averaged over 20. But a lot of that is just because he came into an established team already. But I think a lot of people, and I do this sometimes too, extrapolated as pretty soon Denver's going to have 3 24-point-per-game scores. And we've never seen that. It's actually literally never happened. And so at some point you start to say, well, who's going to be the guy that has to step back? I don't think it's Jokic. He's too good. He's a two-time MVP. He's too important. He's the better scorer and passer. It's not going to be him. Could it be Jamal Murray? There's a world in which Michael Porter surpasses him. But I think it's more likely that the dynamic is similar to the Andrew Wiggins one, where you have the Murray-Jokic system, and that's your system. And you have this other option that's almost a bailout option that you could grow into, where you can, unlike Golden State, I think Denver has an even better pick and roll. Like, Golden State runs Curry off of all these other actions. It's dynamic, but it's not necessarily just spread out. Now let's run a pick and roll. I think the Murray Jokic pick and roll can be that. So it's a little harder, because I still want them to go to that late in shot clocks. But I do think there's this, you space the floor, you know, Michael Porter fit into the Murray Jokic system. You're still going to get shots. You're going to space. You're going to make the offense better. And late shot, we're going to find these quick ISOs where 5 seconds on the clock, we get it to you, and you just get to turn and shoot over guys. And maybe that means you only score 18 points per game, but you're also a great rebounder. You can do the Andrew. He could almost be the Andrew Wiggins facsimile, better on offense, probably worse on defense, but it might have the same impact. And I think I'm getting to that's the guy that has to sacrifice in those ways.
I'll push back on that, because I think with Wiggins, over the later in his Wolves career, he did come to the realization that he was not an elite scorer. And he wasn't as good as he thought he was, you know, coming in. And he kind of did need to pick and choose his spots a little bit more. And then Golden State threw him into a place where he could, like, pretty much only pick and choose his spots. And it would be kind of awkward if he tried to take more of the pie. And from afar, with Michael Porter Jr. To put it bluntly, I don't think he thinks he's bad at anything yet. And Wiggins, right. You know, so I would struggle to see Porter Jr. like.
Oh, I would too. I would struggle to see it for sure. I'm
all right. I thought you were saying you're like, oh, I think that's what's going to happen. Cause
I think it'll at least
take time. Yeah.
I do not think that is what is going to happen. But the more I think about it, and it's, again, we can get lost in the one-to-one comparison because it's not one-to-one. I actually think he needs to be more of a Clay Wiggins hybrid. It's just, when you talk about who is going to be the one that sacrifices, I don't think Denver can bend their offense to fit Porter as much as Porter can bend his game to fit Denver's offense. And that's the thing that I think is so tough about the situation. But if it works out, if you do end up with a half Wiggins, half Clay hybrid, a guy that shoots like Clay and moves around the perimeter, but that you can throw it to on the elbow with 5 seconds left and he can just do a one dribble move and make something of it. To me, that's a perfect blend. That's how you blend the talents.
Do you remember in the last game six or game five of the finals when Van Gundy was like, somebody subbed out and he goes, okay, Andrew Wiggins is going to need to be more aggressive here. And immediately on that possession, he went in and he went to the bucket. And the reason Van Gundy said that was because it was just Steph out there. There's no Clay, no Draymond, no Poole, if I remember correctly. And it's in those situations where it's not only that Wiggins needs to be aggressive in that spot, you got to look for him in that spot. So when I think about Porter Jr. in Denver, I think it's going to be really important for Malone to hit his rotations effectively. So there's these times where it's just Porter Jr. and Murray out there.
Yep.
Like, that's what I would do for sure. All 10 minutes a game that Jokic is off the floor, Porter's in that whole time. And you got to be intentional about getting him his a little bit in those times. Again, it goes back to the, like, this is a little less efficient than what we're used to in this time and situation, it makes more sense to let Michael Porter Jr. take his fadeaway 16 footer, because that's probably going to be, you know, better offense than running some other action for a lesser score on that team. So I think he needs to situationally be aggressive there, and they need to be aggressive about getting him the ball in those situations, which is something I think Kerr has done a really good job at with Wig throughout this season and certainly in these finals here.
And I think the players too, like, there's the vocalness to Draymond Green and even Steph Curry that both encourages guys and also reins them in. And that's kind of what you're talking about. I think when we're talking about Porter's role, we're really talking about, and I hate to make the game the simple, a lot of things matter. The NBA comes down to what you are at the end. Like, what are you in clutch time? And that's what I'm talking about. But there's no question Denver will basically have three versions of themselves next year. They're the start with all three of those guys on the court, with Porter and Jokic on the court, and with Murray Jokic on the court, or Murray Porter on the court. Like, any configuration of two of them, and then what they are when they're all together. And the more important one is what they are when they're all together, because that's how you close. Oftentimes, games come down to the last 7 minutes within 3 points. That's where your knockout punch comes. So that's kind of what I mean. But it's interesting. It's just, that's the challenge, and it's not lost to me. Jokic's last words we heard him say before his MVP speech was basically, I know we can win a championship but only if we learn to play together. And, like, I know he's talking about Michael Porter in this moment, because not as a shot at him, but because he's the one guy who is so talented, but that hasn't quite happened yet. For a lot of that is because of injuries, but, you know, also because of his style of play. So that's the whole story to me for the Nuggets next season. And I'm excited.
Can I do one more distinction between Porter Jr. and Wiggins?
I think
one thing with Wig his whole time here is all of his teammates loved him. Like, they were all cool with him. Every iteration of the team, million different players, like, all those guys liked Wiggins. And I think that went a long way in kind of, like, sharing the bread a little bit, you know? And it's what's helped him a lot in Golden State. Not only, like, take a lesser role, but I think his teammates, because they like him, are like, all right, Wig's taking a lesser role here. Let's take care of him too. And again, I don't know enough about the personality dynamics of the Nuggets big three, but again, from afar, I don't know if that's at this age, and maybe Michael Porter Jr. hasn't flipped that light switch I was talking about before on, but I think cohesion of personalities is huge when you have a player the caliber of Andrew Wiggins or Michael Porter Jr., who are just great athletes, good basketball players. When they take a lesser role, the other guys got to be aware of that and want to take care of them too. And yeah, I mean, that's why Michael Porter Jr. is kind of this X factor with them there. And so much of it to me is about personality less than it is about certainly what Porter Jr. can do on the offensive end, because that's, I mean, that's a 10.
It's a really great point. I think the only pushback I'd put is I don't think Michael Porter's hated by anyone, but to your point, I thought Murray and Jokic got closer in the bubble because they were under enormous amount of pressure and they went through some real battles. And that's where you really kind of, you know, in the foxhole, you really make some close friends and allies there. And I just, Porter and Jokic went through last year's playoffs. There was a little bit of that, maybe a little bit of that bonding, but it just hasn't been sustained. It's been 2 months break, 3 months injury, 2 months surgery.
So and maybe that's all you need is just that continuity for a while. Yeah.
Maybe, I don't know, but maybe that's one thing that I kind of want to say, but this is a big year. I think by the end of this year, we probably will know the answer to that question about whether or not he can grow into that role, whether he gets along on that level and kind of goes through those battles and comes out the other side. Dane, you're the best at what you do. I really appreciate you coming on. I thought this was great, man. I thought we had a little short topics and we ended up talking about basketball philosophy.
Yeah, man. Enjoy Ryan and try and get to know him again. Like, great dude. He grew up like right by me. We're like the same age.
Awesome.
He's as much of as you gave me a positive review of Tim Connelly and who he is as a person. I mean, I'd same exact thing with Ryan. Great, great guy.
Awesome. Can't wait for it. Matt Moore is back tomorrow. I am off, but we'll both be back on Friday. Don't forget, you can check out all things Timberwolves on the Dane Moore Basketball Podcast. We'll see everybody tomorrow.